The more Marcy screamed, the more excited the three thieves became. They knew they were too low. They knew they should quiet her. They knew there was a dog nearby and they could not control dogs, but they also knew that they could reach into her and taste of her emotions, and the taste would fill them with a delicious fire that their kind did not possess, the fire of strong feeling. Man might not be intelligent enough to save himself from the environmental imbalance overpopulation had caused on his planet, but his emotional genius was beyond compare. They dug into her gushing terror like wolves digging into the flowing guts of a deer, and the collective at first reacted with surprise. Then it raged. Connor thought the female voice was his mother screaming, and she thought that it was him. They met in the living room and threw their arms around each other. Then Dan said, "There's a light in the field." From their perspective on their rear deck, it was clear that none of the houses were involved. Connor and Caitlin stayed behind while Dan, wearing slippers and a robe, went out onto the deck and down into the backyard. He carried a flashlight. Their scraggly yard was quiet. The toys of summer, the slide, the swing set, the empty above-ground pool, were sentinels in the dark light of the setting moon. He moved toward the glow, which was in the field beyond the end of the yard, past a stand of narrow third or fourth growth pines. Caitlin and Connor came out on the deck. "I think it's a fire in the field," he said. "Are you serious?"
"Oh, God, somebody help me. Somebody help me."
Caitlin clutched her son. "Connor, we're going back in." Connor broke away from her and went racing down the deck stairs.
"Look at that,"
he yelled. As he and Dan crossed the yard, hurrying toward the thin woods, a huge light loomed up from below the tree line. They stopped, stunned by the second moon rising. Caitlin arrived beside them. "Connor, put this on."
"Thanks, Mom."
He dug his arms into a jacket. "You know what that is?"
"No."
Dan walked closer to the edge of the woods.
"Can we help you?" he shouted.
"Don't go too close, Dad."
The thing seemed to wobble, then rise.
"It's moving this way, Dan."
It hung above the woods, not a sound now.
"I think it's a balloon," Caitlin said.
Then more screams whipped out, shrill to cracking.
"A balloon is on fire," Caitlin shouted.
The three of them ran again, fumbling in the brush, guided by the light.
"Who in the world would be up on a hot air balloon at night?" Connor asked.
"And that's not fire. That's a piezoelectric effect of some kind. Look at it shimmer."
"It's a student," Caitlin said.
"Something's gone wrong with some prank."
It wasn't anything to do with hazing, not in February, but it could indeed be a prank. Every house that backed onto the field was occupied by a Bell College professor. The three thieves looked out across the electromagnetic haze that flowed off the wires with which humans surrounded their shelters. Sharp eyes watched Connor and Dan. Dan paused in the woods.
"Maybe nothing's gone wrong. Maybe the screaming is the prank."
"I hope so," Caitlin said, calmer now, embracing this most reasonable of probabilities.
"Come on," Connor said.
Before them, as they left the woods, they saw people running toward the object from various directions. Harley Warner, but not Paulie or his mother or sister, Chris and Nancy Jeffers, and the entire Kelton family, robes flying, Manrico barking furiously but hanging well back. Jimbo Kelton was using a video camera, and Nancy Jeffers held her cell phone out like some kind of shield, no doubt taking pictures with it. Another scream pealed out.
Dan shouted, "Do you need help?"
He hoped it was just a prank because Bell did not need adverse publicity, not with the sort of enrollment problems faced by a small college located at the burnt-out end of a bus line that only served what the college brochure gamely called the sophisticated little city of Wilton. What sophistication there might be in a row of closed stores and a grain elevator was anybody's guess.
"Oh, God, God!"
The words seemed to ring in the trees, to leave their narrow trunks trembling.
"Can't you see she's in real trouble?" Connor yelled.
He took off toward the object. The one watched Connor, while the two and the three regarded Marcy with the reverent cunning of boys in a candy store. The two drew closer, now pressing his face into her churning aura. Angry static bounced around the tiny space. The collective was furious that they were not performing as directed. which made little difference. The 1,000 Greys who were here were spread all over the planet, feeding in Brazil and Britain and China, mining gravitite in the iron deposits of New York, extracting helium-3 fuel on the moon. They were linked to the Great Collective, yes, but it was moving toward Earth far more slowly than the lead group. So what could it actually do? Nothing. And they would carry out its orders, eventually. The Three Thieves would have been more efficient with Marcy, but the luscious fears, the darting hopes, the bright wet desires that filled her smooth flesh were just too much of a temptation. Dan Callahan was awake anyway, so the whole expedition was a waste. They might as well make of it whatever they could. The two, as the negative pole of the triad, showed her a long needle. Her eyes widened as she saw the silver of it appearing out of the dark that surrounded her. She could not see the thieves, of course. They were too careful for that. He plunged the needle into her forehead, and she shrieked, and they gobbled her agony. For the moments that it lasted, feeling as alive as their distant ancestors must have before they had enhanced themselves with machine intelligence and lost contact with the only thing that mattered in the end, which was feeling. Without it, life was ongoing death, and to find it again, crossing a galaxy was as nothing, not even if the journey took 50 generations, not even if it took 1,000. From 1 billion times 1 billion miles away, they had seen Earth glowing with emotion. It had drawn them like excited moths to its mystery, first in hundreds, then in thousands. And soon the billions would come to drink the healing waters of the human soul, if all went well. The Keltons went close, running low like actors on a movie battlefield. It occurred to Dan that Jimbo Kelton might be recording the prank for the later amusement of fellow perpetrators. All the people in the neighborhood were not only known to each other, they counted one another as friends. Nancy and Chris were dear friends of Caitlin and Dan. Kelton was a historian working at the far end of the campus from the Hall of Science, but still a member of the cozy Little Oak Road crowd. The Warners and the Callahans were very close, or had been. Nancy clutched her cell phone to her ear. Dan felt for his, miraculously found it in a pocket of his jacket. He punched in 911. "This is Dr. Daniel Callahan, 103 Oak Road. There's a fire in the field behind our house that borders Wilton Road. Somebody's trapped in it." The screams lost form, became a continuous roar of pain. Dan closed his cell phone while the dispatcher was still talking. He was now convinced that this was serious. Those screams were real. He took off after Connor, going flat out. "Don't let him near it," Caitlin howled, passing him in her pursuit of her son. As Dan ran, he looked for the basket for the burning student, but he could see only the fearsome glare, like looking into 1,000 car headlights or a flashbulb that would not quit. He shielded his eyes and struggled closer. "Connor! Connor, where are you?" "I can't see him, Dan! Connor! Connor!" Another scream came, trembling and high, desolate with agony. Then the object wavered a little in the air. Far off, the thin wail of a siren could be heard, then more sirens getting louder. "Connor, oh, thank God!" He was with the Kelton boys, his small form hidden in the bulk of their teenage bodies. "Come on, we're getting out of here," Caitlin said. "Mom!" "Come on." She took him by the wrist, yanked him away, heading back toward their empty house. "No!" He broke away. And suddenly, she was terribly afraid, afraid for her son. He was vulnerable. To what, she did not know. But she knew that he was vulnerable. "Connor, please, I am begging you right now to come back with me. Mom, I think I know what this is. Connor, no, you have no idea. Nobody does. But it's not right, and it's dangerous." He threw his arms around her. "Mom, don't worry." In an instant, he had broken away and was running back into the light. The thieves were concerned now. Connor should not be here, and they could feel the fury and the fear of the whole collective. Of course everybody was scared. Their survival depended on this child, who had been bred through 50 human generations. Caitlin had the awful and frightening sense that the thing was somehow watching her son. She took off after him, her feet slamming into the winter-hard ground, and she tackled him and brought him down. It made him cry out in astonishment. Caitlin had never disciplined him physically. Such a thing was unthinkable, to humiliate a brilliant child in that way, or any child for that matter. She got up on all fours, crying, trying to keep herself between him and the thing. She had the hideous feeling that it would somehow suck him into its fire, and he would join the poor woman who was screaming there. He stood up. Glaring down at her, he turned away from the object and strode back toward the house, thanking God in her heart. She followed her son home.
5. The young lieutenant handed Colonel Robert Langford a sheet of paper. "My God," he said as he read it. "Sir?" "This is under the blanket," he said. The young man, who was not cleared to hear what was about to be said, left the room. The glow boy that had been snooping around Wilton, Kentucky, had just done something that Rob had never seen, and that he was quite sure no monitor had seen from the beginning of this mission, which dated back to 1942. He pulled up a satellite view of Wilton. The glowboy was bright, its plasma fully deployed. The thing was ready to move out of there fast. He zoomed in on the image. Disbelieving, he zoomed in on it again. What in hell were people doing crowding around the thing? The Greys considered their secrecy essential, and they had threatened dire consequences if it was ever compromised. But they themselves were breaking it, and also breaking a fundamental policy of the United States of America, which was to keep their secret until and if something could be said to the public other than, "We know they're here, we know that they come into your bedrooms and kidnap you in the night, but we don't know why, and we are helpless to stop them, and yes, some of you disappear, and some of you die." He stared at the image, watching the figures move, trying to form some sort of a rational explanation of what might be happening. Rob spent too much time in the mountain, or so he'd been told by practically everybody who worked with him, because the Greys operated at night, and tracking their movements was his duty. Over the years, he'd gradually become a night person. Mike Wilkes had negotiated a treaty with the Greys, using the interface between Bob and Adam and Eamon Glass. The agreement was that they would limit their abductions in number and region. In return, the United States had guaranteed to protect their secrecy. It was Rob's job to keep track of the abductions and, in the most extreme cases of treaty violation, to put up a show of force. This was not to be done lightly. The Greys would not stand to be fired upon. That had been tried back in the 40s, and the reply had been horrifying. The Greys had caused 600 plane crashes in the year 1947. Shortly thereafter, President Truman had ordered that they were not to be interfered with in any way. Nobody cared to challenge the Greys, but now was one of those dreadful moments when something had to be done. Early on, there had been a fear that the Soviets would find out how the collective minds of the Greys worked, and announce to the world something like, "We have seen the future, and it is communist." However, nobody except the United States Air Force possessed a Grey. Therefore, the rest of the world, including the remaining U.S. military, the intelligence community, and the government, was at best minimally informed. Within the Air Force, fewer than 20 people knew about this project. He put his hand on the phone. There was nobody else in the world who could make this decision or could even offer advice. If he was wrong, there was just no way to tell what the Greys would do. Could he bring about the end of the world when he picked up the phone? He lifted the receiver, punched in some numbers. "Jimmy, Rob, do you have my Glowboy coordinates?" "Yes, sir. It's been groundbound for a while, sir." "I need a scramble out of Alfred moving on it instamente." "Yes, sir." He paused, took a deep breath. "God be with us," he said into the phone. His next step was to inform Wilkes of what was happening, and that required setting up a listening device on the call. Mr. Crewe expected all contacts with Wilkes to be logged, recorded, and sent to him. Personally, Rob was convinced that Crewe was right to be suspicious of Wilkes. He believed that the man was using the empaths to discover new technologies and selling them to the private sector. Also, Wilkes's pathological hatred of the Greys was inappropriate. He believed that they were bent on invasion. They scared him, and that's why he hated them. But hate does not win wars. Knowledge does. And that's what Wilkes's empath unit was supposed to be gaining from the one remaining Grey in captivity. But damn little useful information came out of the new empath. Rob did not understand the Greys, but he didn't hate them. In fact, he found them incredibly interesting. They'd been here for 50 years, and they hadn't invaded yet, so that didn't seem to be a very real concern. What they did to people was weird, but you didn't see folks disappearing or being injured, at least not physically. Obviously, though, whatever the Greys were doing to the people they abducted was damned important to them. Otherwise, there would not be threats. They were taking something from us, no question of that, but in the way a farmer takes milk, not meat. The information flow, Rob believed, was being shunted to Wilkes's real buddies, the quiet companies who fed off the United States' $120 billion annual black budget. In Rob's opinion, there was a pipeline that led through Wilkes from Adam right back to the industry. It would certainly explain why an Oklahoma orphan boy, who had nothing to live on but his soldier's pay, called a multi-million-dollar house in Georgetown home, and why an officer whose work was in a hole 200 feet below Indianapolis, Indiana, ever needed a presence inside the Beltway. "Mike, it's Rob. Sorry about the late hour, but I have a situation. There's a glow boy on the ground near Wilton, Kentucky. I know it's very odd and very disturbing. What's even more of a concern is that there are civilians in the field around him. He's got his plasma deployed and he's ready to run, but he ain't running. There have got to be video cameras down there, all kinds of trouble. I'm doing a scramble. I've got to get that guy out of there. Do you think you could get Glass in the hole with Adam? Let's reassure him that it's just a friendly warning that they might spill their own secret. And let's please find out what we can about what in Sam Hill they're up to." He waited until he heard Wilkes's grunt of assent. The good colonel did not like to be dictated to, which is why Rob did just that whenever he had a chance. Alfred Air Force Base was a training facility. It was still up and running largely because Kentucky's senior senator was a member of the Armed Services Committee and powerful enough to hold on to his bases. Whatever, Rob was damned relieved that the place was still operational. He widened the image on the overhead satellite, punched a couple of keys, and saw a white outline of the base superimposed over its location. The base was barely 30 miles from the unfolding incident. In the field in Kentucky, they were standing in helpless amazement, watching the object. Nancy Jeffers had gone home, because she and her husband had no wish to leave their baby alone with something like this taking place. Caitlin and Connor were also gone, and Dan was just as glad. A child had no business out here, and he thought that Kelton was letting his boys get way too close with that camera of theirs. Without warning, a clap of thunder hit. Dan cried out. They all did. Chris Jeffers covered his head with his hands. Dan saw a double star wheeling in the sky. Then he heard the shriek of a jet, and realized that what he was looking at were afterburners. "It's the Air Force," he shouted. Its underside glowing in the light being given off by the object, the fighter howled past so low that a hot stench of burning jet fuel washed over them. The object turned purple. It moved, wobbling above the ground. The voice in the thing cried out, "Help me, help me. Oh, God, no. No, no, no." The light rose into the sky. It hung there, still wobbling slightly. The jet's glowing afterburners turned and started back. "Stop it! Stop that!" came the voice. Then more screaming. "Ah, ah, ah, oh, ah!" Maggie Warner screamed with her, crying into the agony of it. In that instant, the object rose 100 feet or so, then shot off to the north, literally like a bullet. It went faster than Dan had ever seen anything go. The jet passed over again, its engine screaming. It turned and followed the object. They watched the afterburners creep away into the sky. Into the silence that followed, Chris said, "God help her." "That was a UFO," young Jimbo Kelton announced. Maggie asked, "Was that a UFO?" "Dear heaven," Harley Warner said. "I think so." Dan was looking at a small shadow in the field, standing where the glow had been. "Folks," he said, I don't think we're alone here." But when he shone his flashlight toward it, there was nothing there. 6. Lauren Glass was enjoying Teddy Blaine's lovemaking, powerful and persistent from this sweet, rough guy. As a fellow Air Force officer, he was carefully disinterested in Lauren's classified work, and that made this particular affair very fun and very easy. As long as she was involved in heavily classified work, Lauren's plan was to keep the lovers moving through her life, nobody deep, because it made it too hard to keep her secrets. When Colonel Wilkes called her, she tried to ignore it. She pushed the chiming out of her mind, concentrated on the warmth under the covers and the fabulous young man who was loving her. The warble became a whine. "Oh, Lauren," Teddy whispered, sinking down onto her, burying his face in her neck, kissing her now gently, pressing his prickled cheek against her soft one. "My love," she said, and thought that she really did kind of mean it, which meant, should she ditch him on the never-get-too-close theory? The whine became a wail. He jerked like he'd been stuck with a pin. "I don't believe this." "My cert's up," she said, referring to the security certification system on her computer, which started automatically when she began receiving a classified message. But why was he after her now at, what, geez, it was 3 a.m.? She'd been in the cage for 6 hours yesterday, waiting without result for Adam to at least take a breath, and she was most certainly not ready to return to his dark, claustrophobic hole. Throwing off the cover, she went over and typed her password. Code came up, 4 lines, which she sight-read. "They've got a virus," she muttered, striving not to reveal to him her true horror. The message communicated extreme urgency. Something was wrong. Real wrong. "Let somebody else fix it." "I have to go," she said, going to her closet and starting to dress. "Miss Indispensable." "Unfortunately." Zipping her jeans, she went over and kissed him. "I'll be back, love," she said. He drew her toward the bed. Briefly, she sat down. They kissed. She looked into his eyes. She sighed. "You know the rules." And she realized how much she hated what she did, how deeply, profoundly twisted it felt. But she loved the perks. And quite frankly, she was also sort of okay with Adam. The facility was a hole. But at the bottom of that hole was a most extraordinary being. The thought that Adam might not be well crossed her mind. That made her hurry even more. She threw on a sky-blue cashmere sweater and her black jacket. After a perfunctory brush of her hair, she strode across her large living room and out the door. She did not look back toward Ted. When she returned, he might well be gone. Fine. She'd rustle up another roll in the hay. Maybe a civilian this time. She had a lot for a girl of 26. But she did a lot. As far as anybody knew, there was only one person on this earth who could do what she did. No doubt there were others, but how to find them? The Air Force had never been able to succeed at that, which was fine by her, since it meant that she could name her price, which had been promotion to full colonel. So now Mike's orders were requests, but this was one she would certainly meet. In the elevator, she turned her mind to her work. What could be wrong? She wished the elevator would go faster. She arrived in the condo's garage, strode to her car, and sped off to the facility. It wasn't far. She couldn't live far from Adam. She turned 2 corners onto Hamilton and made her way down the tree-shaded street to the old house. Wilkes met her at the door, which was unusual in the extreme. "A glowboy kiped a newbie in the Forbidden Zone, and there were civilian witnesses," he said all in one breath. "I want you to query Adam on it." "Why?" "Because it's so extremely unusual, obviously."
"You understand, they don't have the concept of treaty. They don't know what that is. And they futz with newbies all the time. You just don't see them do it because they stay in the approved zones."
"You know this."
"What if I told you that they're a rambunctious, fun-loving bunch of extremely brilliant but weird people? How would that sit?"
"First, they're not people. Second, they are not only extremely brilliant, they're extremely sinister and they have no emotions."
"Adam showed grief when Dad got killed."
"He was faking it."
"Plus he... I don't know how to put it. It's not a human emotion, not at all, but he does care about me."
"You're projecting. End of story. Now let's go down. We have work to do."
As they waited for the elevator, he added,
"We have a scramble running on the Glowboy, incidentally."
"Oh, great. How do I explain that?"
"Communicate that it's a friendly warning. The civilians are liable to have cameras. There could be a security breach that's beyond our control."
"Wunderbar."
She was annoyed when Wilkes got into the elevator with her. She did not like him around when she and Adam were together. A few moments later, the doors opened onto the control room, and beyond it, the huge door that sealed Adam's space. As Lauren stripped, Andy began opening a fresh prep kit. She dropped her sweater to the floor and rubbed her temples.
"So I need to find out why this triad is off station."
Lauren threw off her clothes in front of both men. Let them see. She was proud of what she was.
"Lauren, I need concrete information from you on this."
She let Andy cover her body with the emollients that would protect every inch of her skin.
Over the years, she'd gotten drier and drier from the zero humidity conditions in the cage. At 26, she had the skin of a 40-year-old. She caked her face in Vaseline. Andy's hands felt only clinical to her, but she was aware that she did not feel clinical to him. She knew because of the way he would turn away when he was finished, his cheeks burning, poor guy. She pulled on her orange coverall, zipped it, and wrapped the neck shield tightly. Andy fitted a cap. Then she rolled her heavy latex gloves onto her hands. She faced the steel door. Andy pushed up the sleeve of her coverall and injected her. "Sorry," he said, as always. He kissed her then, very quickly, on the place he'd just pricked. She opened the door, stepped into the airlock, and waited. The inner door hissed and slid aside. She entered her secret heaven and hell, the world of love and terror that she shared with Adam. Seven. As a social scientist, Caitlin Callahan understood the impulse to congregate after a tragedy, which was why the Jeffers had returned, baby and carrier, and now sat before the Callahan fireplace. The Keltons had rushed home to study their video, the Warners to keep their excited kids from doing anything rash. Hell's Gate had opened for somebody tonight, and now there must be congregation. The ancient holy act that was intended, by deepest human instinct, to declaim the persistence of life. Chris and Nancy sat with straight backs, methodically sipping wine. 6-month-old Jilly slept in her carrier between them, her little mouth open, her pacifier in her hand. Caitlin wanted only to go downstairs to Connor. As irrational as it probably was, she was nevertheless experiencing an urge to guard him, and this urge was growing by the minute. Nervously, she paced in front of the fireplace, drinking rather than sipping. She feared that Connor might go back out there on his own. That was why the Warners were staying home to keep Paulie in. Connor could easily leave via the door that led from his basement room under the deck and out into the yard. She stepped onto the deck and looked out across the yard. No movement. Total silence. It had seemed like half the campus police department, the entire volunteer fire department, county emergency services, and the state police had come. None of the official types had seen the light, but the Air Force jet had still been maneuvering around when they came, at least. Police Chief Dunst had called the Alfred AFB, only to be told that there were no fighters in the air at that time. No planes at all, in fact. He'd closed his cell phone in disgust. "Guess that was a privately owned F-15 on afterburners," he muttered. The emergency crews had combed the field with infrared detectors. It had all been very impressive, but it would have been more impressive if they had found something resembling human remains, or even a shard of debris of some sort. "Well," Nancy said at last, "what do we think?" "We think some damn kids are in big trouble. I mean, I saw the Air Force out there," Caitlin said. "Dan, Danny Dan." Chris laughed silently. "No, Chris," Nancy said. "No? With regard to what?" "With regard to the fact that you think it was a flying saucer." "With an abductee aboard, yes. I do think that." Now it was Nancy's turn to drink deep. She glared at her husband. "I don't want to hear this."
"It's true, though."
"Maybe, and maybe not, but I do know one thing. We're here because of this UFO stuff. Shunted off into this backwater with barely enough of a salary to raise our baby, and it's because you side with the trailer trash instead of your fellow physicists. Excuse me, folks. Family stuff."
"No, it's true," Dan said. "Everybody here is a failure somewhere else. They're real, they're here, and my colleagues are wrong. If that video..."
"Don't you dare go on TV about this, Chris. Don't you dare."
Chris raised his hands defensively. "Be it far from me, unless..."
"Unless nothing. No more, Chris. I have gone from Caltech to UMass to this because of your damn UFOs. Below here, we are looking at the junior college pit."
"I reserve judgment until I have seen the video. If it's as good as I think it's going to be, it might just get us back to Caltech."
"You are so fired, Chris. You will never, ever get back there. My God, you made a public idiot of yourself on national television."
"I told the truth."
He had appeared on Dateline as an advocate for the reality of UFOs, and his status as a Caltech professor had been used to give him credibility. Within a year, he was out. At UMass, It had been an article in the Boston Globe that had quoted his Dateline statements. He lasted 6 months that time. Dan told himself to keep out of it. But then he thought that the poor woman was just so vulnerable with that little baby, and as much as he liked Chris, he was way off base on this one. Alien abduction is seizure-related folklore. Did I ever tell you that I suffered from waking nightmares when I was a child? Which is why I know what this is. I saw these little figures. Yeah, me, Chris. I'm an abductee by your rather dubious, excuse me, standards. But because I also happen to possess a little professional knowledge of the brain, I know where the aliens come from. He pointed to his own head, the same place that ghosts and demons and, whatever, goblins come from, and not from some damn field on the outskirts of a one-horse town in Kentucky. Officially, I believe that Wilton is classified as a half-horse town. Whatever, we saw a prank. It was terrifying, and now the Air Force is involved, and there's likely to be hell to pay for these students in this institution, and that is a damn crying shame. Although they do deserve it. The students, not poor Bell. The Air Force said they weren't there.
Dan, Nancy asked, are you concerned about your tenure bid? You must be.
She turned to her husband. Because he won't involve you. That I will not let him do. All the witnesses. Don't even start, Chris, my dear love. Dan and Caitlin did not see this. And Kelton, look at him. He's on thin ice as it is. The history department's a basket case. Don't involve them, Chris. Don't you dare. She looked at Dan. How's it going, by the way?
Marcy is how it's going.
Marcy is your referee. You've got to be kidding. She hasn't voted yes on a tenure since Clinton was in the White House. Now Dan went for the bottle, poured a glass, sucked it dry.
This is pretty bad, he said, looking at the label. $6 at Kroger, don't knock it, Chris said. Now, listen to me. I don't want to set you off again, but you do realize that this is a historical event. A large group of witnesses, armed in some cases with video equipment, have observed, and I hope, recorded a UFO on the ground up close, exhibiting every evidence of the presence of an abductee inside, which I intend to proclaim to the world. Chris, shut up.
He looked at his mild-mannered wife in open astonishment.
Excuse me?
Just you shut up. Are you hard of hearing or something? Okay, look, you do this, and you do it without me and Jilly because we will be gone.
Where?
Anywhere.
Nancy, this is proof.
Oh, Jesus. Junior college, here we come. She stood up. I think I'm leaving. She picked up Jilly in her carrier. What Caitlin feared was that there had been a murder out there, involving God only knew what sort of bizarre method. A murder and, perhaps if the shadow Dan had seen was really somebody, a murderer who was still nearby. If you get yourself fired, Nancy told Chris as she pulled on her coat.
Expect divorce papers, mister. Let's approach it from the direction of each of our specialties, Chris suggested.
He seemed unbothered by his wife's outburst, and indeed Nancy did not actually walk out the door. Caitlin thought, it's a real marriage then, they're long haulers like us. She knew where this kind of fight took you in the end. It took you to bed.
Well, certainly, she said, attempting to move things to a somewhat calmer level.
From the standpoint of the sociologist, we witnessed a real physical event that I fear was tragic. We all do, or we wouldn't be here huddled together in the back of the proverbial cave in the dead of the night.
Dan said, I'm in agreement that it wasn't a hallucination. It was a prank, and possibly somebody was injured. I agree there. Unless some genius actress has just recently emerged here at Bell, which I very much doubt.
I thought Death of a Salesman was pretty good, Chris said.
Dan smiled.